Christian Piccolini's in our studio. Welcome back, Christian. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too, John.
How are you going to vote on our news click?
Oh, I'm supporting it. I love Nike for what they did and for supporting the communities that they know they need to support.
You are the author of a book called...
White American Youth.
White American Youth. And when that book came out, you came onto our show. I read the book in a weekend. It was just stunning what you, this reformed white extremist, went through and the transformation you were able to make into a person who is now trying to fight back against the hate in the world, particularly what we saw in Charlottesville and throughout the country. You are the producer of Breaking Hate on MSNBC, which aired again last Sunday night. And again, the author of White American Youth. You're writing another book too, right?
I am. I'm writing kind of the follow-up to the memoir. And this is more of a self-help memoir, and it's going to be called The Intervention of a Nation.
I'll talk to you about that in a second. I mostly wanted you to come on to talk about Breaking Hate, this MSNBC thing, which you may have seen, which you may yet see, but was just remarkable for what it did. And we'll talk about that. But off the air, you were telling me that you support, let's just finish this conversation about Colin Kaepernick for a second,
sure,
if you don't mind. He donated to your foundation, right?
Yeah, when I was with Life After Hate, he had donated, he was going around donating, spending a year donating money to organizations that were smaller, that weren't really in the public eye.
And that's that. Think about this. So yeah. There you were, a white. Finish that. You were a white what?
I was a neo-Nazi white supremacist skinhead.
And he gave $20,000 of his dollars to you.
He did.
Why?
Because he believed in us, and he believed in the work that we were doing, and he wanted to bring that to light. And this was in response to the Trump administration pulling a $400,000 grant from us at the time.
You guys had a $400,000 grant?
We did. We at the time, we had applied under the Obama administration for the grant to develop an online intervention program, because so many young people are being radicalized online into all sorts of extremist groups. And we had won it, and we were kind of on a platform where they put us out as really great examples of this award. And then the administration changed over, and then a couple months after the switchover, while we were waiting for the check, we got a nice email saying, sorry, but no thanks.
Why did they do that?
I don't know. We were never told.
Do you think it was political, or do you think it was just maybe budgetary?
Well, it wasn't budgetary, because they had the money already allocated to 38 groups who'd won this grant, and we were one of the 38, and out of the 38, we were the only one who was rescinded. We were also the only one that focused on white supremacy.
So in the book you wrote, and this has been your life, you grew up in Chicago on the south side?
South side, southwest side.
And give me the elevator speech about what happened.
Well, you know, I mean, Chicago's a great working class city in the southwest side. You know, the neighborhood that I lived in, Blue Island, was kind of a lower middle class neighborhood. My parents are Italian immigrants who came over from Italy in the 60s. And you know, I wasn't raised with any real racism or hate. My parents were the victims of prejudice when they came over. But because they were immigrants, they also had to work really, really hard. And that, as a kid, I didn't really understand why they were gone 7 days a week, 14 hours a day.
You resented a lot of that.
I did.
And then there was a man who surfaced in your life who, for the first time, made you feel good about your heritage.
Yeah, when I was 14 years old, as this angry, you know, teen acting out, I was standing in an alley, I was smoking a joint, and this guy walked up to me with a shaved head and boots. It was 1987, so nobody really knew what a skinhead was in America anyway. And he took the joint from my mouth, and he looked me in the eyes, and he said, that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile. I'm not lying to you one word, John, when I tell you I didn't know what a communist was, I didn't know what a Jew was, and I didn't know what the word docile meant. I was this, you know, 14-year-old kid who had no friends, who grew up kind of marginalized and you know, really shy. And that man walked up to me and he kind of threw me a lifeline. It felt as though he was the first person to kind of accept me, even though he was, you know, pulling a joint from my mouth.
Manipulating you too, though.
He did, because what he did after he pulled that joint out of my mouth was he comforted me. He asked me if I was Italian after he asked me what my name was. And then he started to, you know, regale me with these stories about the Roman Empire and how, you know, strong of warriors they were and philosophers and artists, and, you know, kind of resonated with me because I'd lived in this Italian bubble on the southwest side of Chicago. And he made me feel important. he was the first person to really do that, and I gravitated to him.
And then slowly indoctrinated you into this white supremacist thinking.
Yeah, he didn't have to do much because I was so willing to mimic what they were what they looked like, what they were saying, you know, the kind of music that they listened to. It kind of was self-radicalizing, even though I was pulled in by this guy who, by the way, was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead. His name was Clark Martel. I wanted to fit in so badly that I would have done anything.
Yeah. The violence that you engaged in was jaw-dropping in the book.
It still is to me. I still have a hard time reconciling that and even thinking that I can make amends for that, even though I try every day.
That you personally took on the University of Illinois football team and won in a bar.
Well, it was me and a couple of other skinheads, but yeah.
Who weren't big and weren't football linemen in the Big Ten. It's
no.
Just stunning, some of the stuff. I will never forget it. And then you make this transformation. You have such a warm smile. You seem like such an affable guy. You look like a wrestler. You look like a strong man, but your demeanor is so calming and pleasant. I don't know how you did that.
Thank you. You know, I think it was always there. I think I was always that shy, introverted, you know, very empathic
person. Isn't that interesting? So maybe some of these skinheads I saw in Charlottesville are little Christian Picciolinis inside.
I can tell you that they are because several of them have reached out to me and I've been working with them, including some of the people who were instrumental in putting that together.
So that was this MSNBC special called Breaking Hate. What did you do there?
So we shot the first of what hopefully will be a 6-part series. The first episode was working with a young man from Louisville. His name was Gabe, who was a hammer skin. He was from the same skinhead group that I'd come from, that I used to lead many, many years ago.
Is that the largest in the country?
I would say it's probably the largest in the world, certainly the most violent skinhead group.
Okay,
anyway.
So keep going.
So this is a 20-year-old kid with tattoos on his face, SS, and swastikas all over his body. And he, I'd been working with him prior to Charlottesville. His mother had reached out to me. And he was making progress, and then I found out from his mother that he had gone to the rally.
We know what happened at the rally.
Yeah.
On the TV show, you then take the woman who was the mother of the woman that was killed.
Yeah. Susan Breaux, who is Heather Heyer's mother, who was killed at that rally.
And you and she met in a church with?
With Gabe, the skinhead with swastikas on his body.
Was he responsible for the death of her daughter?
He was not. He was there. He was part of the larger rally, but he was not involved in the actual
incident. What happened when you sat down in the church?
Well, I kind of just sat back like I always do, and I listened because I really, I wanted them to be able to speak to each other. I'm there to guide, and they were able to connect, although it was awkward. They were able to connect because, frankly, both Heather, the woman who was killed in Charlottesville, and Gabe had a very similar upbringing.
Really?
Yeah, they had both kind of grown up in poverty in a trailer and, had parents who were addicted to drugs and alcohol and kind of found different paths, obviously, but were led there, frankly, by the same things.
Is this your mission, to sort of save these kids one dum-dum at a time?
I always say that had a baseball coach or somebody else come up to me in that alley when I was 14, I would have gone with them instead of the skinhead. So I guess, part of my mission is to be that person that steps into that, dead-end alley behind the corners of Union and Division Streets and be an option.
Christian Picciolini's in our studio. If you have not read the book, White American Youth, it's a Chicago story. Saying ancient history, we're talking late 1980s, which in many ways feels like 2018. And it's just stunningly local and graphic and honest and real. Now, what are you doing now? What can I do for you these days?
Well, you can keep talking about the issues that we have, and you're very good at that. I think there's never been a time in my life, even when I was involved in the movement, where I was more terrified about the atmosphere that's going on and the rhetoric from the highest levels that seems to support the same mission. So keep talking about it.
Really? I mean, I know that the president gets painted as not being tough enough on this issue, but maybe that's an easy shot. Do you think it starts there, or what's the source of this new wave?
I think it feeds they feed each other, right? I mean, we're during times of socioeconomic crisis, of uncertainty. This is when extremist groups tend to pop up because they promise very black and white solutions for very complex problems.
Right. They could do to a whole population what that guy did in the alley for you.
Absolutely.
Promise you something that's a false promise.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe in our history, we've never had that megaphone before where there was that person in the alley when I was 14 years old. It used to hide in corners and in darkness and in shadows. But now, you know, we're hearing it from the bully pulpit, and it's coming from the very top. Though the top is feeding what's happening, you know, at our level, John, the bottom, it also always lived there. It's just now finding a chance to come out.
Founder of Free Radicals. What's the website I can go to help you or to fund you?
FreeRadicals.org.
What a coincidence. FreeRadicals.org. FreeRadicals.org. You're in Chicago now. You've been traveling a lot.
I am. I'm actually heading to New York. I'm so excited. I get to meet one of my all-time heroes, Alan Alda. I'm doing his podcast on Tuesday.
He is one of my heroes.
I've seen every episode of MASH at least a dozen times, and I feel like I know the man, and I've never met him.
When I first started on radio in Chicago, people said, oh, Alan Alda's on the air, because I don't hear, but at least at one point in my life, they said I sounded like Alan Alda, and he is the spitting image of my father.
Is that right?
And I read his book and interviewed him when it came out, and he's a terrific guy. You'll have a great time, and he's going to enjoy Christian Piccolini's company, too. Come back
thanks,
in the
John.
Studio whenever you want.
My pleasure. Thank you.